chapter 2. In verse 9. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And then I want to read one more portion in the 34th Psalm. Psalm 34 and verse 6. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. Well, what I'd like to do this evening is just to show very simply the work of the grace of God in Nigeria, to acquaint you a little bit with our brethren there and the testimony gathered to the name of the Lord Jesus. And I also like to show how that the Lord preserved Brother Walt and I in a very wonderful way and allowed once again that calendars, literature, and Bibles get into the country. Now, just a little background. Brother Walt Van Holstein of the Grand Rapids Assembly has been involved in correspondence to Africa for a number of years. He's also been involved in the shipping of Bibles to that country. And so he'd been exercised for some time to go over to make some contacts and also to meet the brethren. My exercise in going was particularly to visit the assemblies there, as well as to help get the literature into that country once again. It's almost pointless at this stage in things to ship literature into Nigeria, because it just doesn't get there. For example, one of the things we checked on while we were there was a shipment of Bibles that had been sent over about 6 or 7 months previous. It had been sent over by container, and it is sitting on a wharf in Lagos, and it never has been cleared. And so unless you take the stuff yourself and make sure it gets through customs, it's very, very difficult. In fact, it's next to impossible to get things in. And so the other reason we went then was to not only visit the assemblies there, but to take the 1995 Joyful News calendars and wallet calendars, to take a shipment of Bibles, and to take literature to restock the book room in Lagos. The book room in Lagos is run under the direction of John Kemp, and he asked us if we would go this year so that he wouldn't have to make the trip. We had 1,500 pounds of literature, 21 70-pound suitcases. When I raised my eyebrows at John Kemp, he said, "Well, that's no problem, there's two of you." He said, "When I went last year, I took 23 alone." Before I go on, I just want to comment on this verse that I read in 1 Peter 2, because we don't realize in a land like this what the power of darkness really is. Now, I realize that there's a lot of darkness in the United States and Canada, where I come from, and plenty of corruption. But really, you're not aware of it in the same way. And we were in a land where Satan indeed has the upper hand, and the light of Christianity is being given up and substituted for Islam. They now have a Muslim dictator, and the door is slowly closing as far as Christianity goes. And I thought of the verse in connection with the darkness in Egypt, and I know it was physical darkness in Egypt in the days of Pharaoh and the plagues, but it says it was darkness that was felt. And you can feel the moral and spiritual darkness in a land like Nigeria, and it makes you thankful that you live in a land where, at least still in some measure, in an outward way, the light of Christianity prevails. And it makes you thankful for the stability that we have here, and it brings before you the need, too, to pray for those who are in a place of authority and power, that we might continue to enjoy the liberties and the measure of stability that we have. We complain about things in a country like this, but you see it from a little different perspective, as you will understand by the time we're through here this evening. And so I thought of this verse in Peter and how that God has brought us from darkness into his marvelous light, and it's a wonderful thing to have been delivered from the power of Satan and to know the Lord Jesus as our Savior. I just want to show, before we have some slides, how the Lord undertook for us from the very beginning. We were a week late in going because Brother Walt had difficulty getting a visa. He finally was able to get his visa. And so what we decided to do, now, we flew from Chicago, or at least I started my trip from Chicago, because we felt it would be easier, the literature and calendars being created at BTP. We decided it would be easier to fly from Chicago and just put the stuff on the plane from there. However, what Brother Walt ended up doing in the long run is he took his half of the luggage down to Grand Rapids, and he originated in Grand Rapids, flew to Chicago and met me, and then we flew on to Frankfurt and then to Lagos. The day before we were to fly out, Don Rule took me down to O'Hare Airport because I didn't want to walk up to the ticket counter and check in with 11 70-pound suitcases and a carry-on bag. And so I thought it'd be better if they didn't have a surprise. So we went up to the Lufthansa check-in counters. I saw a sign over a desk that said odd-shaped and excess baggage. I stepped up to the counter, and I had really been before the Lord as to how to approach the subject. And so I said to the lady behind the counter, I said, I'm flying to Lagos tomorrow. I explained that I had 11 or 12, whatever it was, extra suitcases. I said, my first question is, will you take them for me? Can I get them on the plane? Well, she punched around in her computer, and after a few moments, she said, yes, they will take them. It'll be $135 per suitcase. Well, I said to her, now, I said, this is Christian literature for free distribution. I said, it's very difficult to get literature into the country now. I said, I wonder if I could speak to someone who would be sympathetic with my cause and perhaps be able to waive at least part of the cost. Well, she said, you'll have to talk to my manager. Now, this is how the Lord worked it out. She called the manager on the PA system, and at that moment, the conveyor belts that take the luggage from the check-in to the plane broke down. And you can imagine how serious a problem that is in O'Hare Airport if they can't get the luggage from the check-in to the planes. Well, she said to me, she said, this man I have just paid is responsible for this problem. I said, that's fine, we have all day to wait. We'll just don't hurry him. Well, after a few minutes, she did page him again. He came rushing across the concourse. He had a cellular phone in one hand and a clipboard in the other. If I could tell he was really in a stew. He rushed up to the counter. I said, I'll tell you in 50 words what I want. I explained very quickly what I had. I don't think he even listened to me. He turned to the girl and he said, give him whatever he wants. And he was gone like that. Well, she punched it into the computer. She said, it's all confirmed. She said, when you check in tomorrow, there'll be no questions asked, and this luggage will go through free of charge. About that moment, the conveyor belts came on again. And so Don and I just looked at one another, and we felt that the Lord had just shut the conveyor belts down long enough so we could get the luggage waived, because I really believe if this man had actually listened to what I wanted, I don't think he would have given me, he would have waived all 11 or 12 bags. However, the next day when we checked in, we had no problem. And so when Walt checked in Grand Rapids, the man said he would split the cost with him. So what it turned out of 21 bags, we only had to pay for 5, which we felt was very, very good. All the luggage got through. In fact, I had less problem in Lagos getting the luggage through than I had getting myself through. The reason being that when I landed in Lagos, I opened my visa and realized that in Ottawa, they had issued me a business visa. I don't know why, because if I had gone to apply for a business visa, they would never have given me one, and it would have been quite a rigmarole anyway. I got to the first customs checkpoint, and there are 4 before you get through. I got to the first one, I had no problem. I got to the second one, And I had no problem except when the girl stamped my passport before she gave it back. She said, now what do you have for me? And that's just how the country operates. Everything operates on the bride. You can't get your passport stamped. You can't move. It's just the way they work. Well, when I came to the senior customs official then, he realized I had a business visa and wasn't going to let me through. Well, finally, he said, I'm going to have to take you upstairs. Well, I had been warned that when they take you upstairs, sometimes you never see the light of day again. And so it was a matter of concern, but the Lord allowed it that the man turned away to talk to somebody else. Walt pulled a Bible and a Joyful News calendar out of his satchel and said, maybe this will help. So when he turned back, now maybe I'll just back up for a moment. You'll understand me when I say that when I visit a country and I have to fill out an immigration form before I get into the country, when they ask me my occupation, I always put pastor, because I feel it's a scriptural term and you have to use terminology that the government officials will understand. And so I had put this on my immigration form, and I had told him that I was just here on a visit, and he knew from my form that I had put pastor. Well, when he turned back, I handed him the Bible and the calendar, and I said, maybe this will help you to understand that I'm just a pastor here on a visit. He said, yes, sir, thank you very much. Go right ahead. Well, what I didn't realize was that Bibles bring a tremendous price on the black market, and it was just cash in this man's pocket. But we were just thankful that we got through and that it is the Word of God, and we just trust that it will be used in blessing. Then at that point, we were able to pick up our luggage. All 21 suitcases came through, and we were able to clear them with little or no difficulty. Now, this is where our difficulty really began, because we came out on the street, and there was no one to meet us. By this time, it was 10 o'clock at night. And John Kemp and Tom Roach and those who have been over to Nigeria had tried to impress upon us that it was imperative that someone meet us, especially since we were going to land at night. However, we had cabled the brethren that we were a week delayed. They had met the plane before, not having got our cable, nor did they get the one that said we were coming the next week, and so they weren't expecting us. Well, I wasn't just sure what to do. We had these carts piled high with literature. Walt said, well, maybe we should ask one of the soldiers. Now, about every 6 feet, there's a soldier with a machine gun. I wasn't sure that was the best idea, because the police and the soldiers are more corrupt than the common people, but I didn't have a better idea at that point. So we asked one of the soldiers what we should do. Well, he said, no difficulty, I'll get you a taxi. Well, it wasn't long till a car pulled up, and they drive cars over there that if they drove them in North America, they'd fall apart, but somehow they hold together over there. This car pulled up. It was a small station wagon, a European car, I think a Saab or one of those, but a very small station wagon. I looked at the man, and I was a little suspicious from the very beginning, because there was no indication, either on his person or on his car, that he was a legitimate cab driver. So I said to him, I said, you'll never get all this luggage in this car. Oh yeah, no problem. Well, he worked at it and he got it all in. I had about this much room in the back of the car to sit, and Walt sat in the front with our two carry-on bags. We were just about touching the pavement. We pulled out from the airport. Instead of pulling onto the main road to go into Lagos, he turned down a deserted street, which I didn't realize at that time, but later I found out led to the domestic airport, which is back-to-back with the international. But the domestic was closed at that point, and so this street was very dark, and this electricity only works sporadically over there, so when it's dark, it's dark. He pulled off into the mud. I stepped out. It was ankle-deep. I said, what's the problem? He said, we've got a flat tire. Well, again, we had been warned about this kind of thing. I looked at the tire, and I said, well, it's a little soft, but it'll certainly make it into Lagos. No, he had to change the tire. Well, the car was so rotten that every time he went to jack it up, it just crumbled, and especially with the weight. And so finally he said, well, I'm going to have to dump your suitcases out. belly dumped our 21 suitcases and our two carry-on bags out in the mud. And thankfully, the Lord had allowed it that in my regular reading, the morning we left Chicago, I had read the 34th Psalm, and particularly the two verses that I have just read. And I stood there on the side of the road and literally quoted those two verses to myself over and over again for 45 minutes. The man changed the tire, he loaded us back up, mud and all, and took us into Lagos. I had agreed to pay him $50 American to take us into Lagos. When we got back in the car, he wanted another $50 for changing the tire. Well, I didn't want to say no, but I wasn't about to give him another $50. So I just popped him along as we went into Lagos and told him I would make it worth his while. I did end up giving him an extra $10. However, that wasn't the end of the story. When we went up for breakfast the next morning and told the man and lady that ran the guest house we were staying at what had happened, the man nearly passed out. He said, I have to go out to the domestic airport this morning to pick up a party that's coming in. He said, why don't you ride along and I'll show you where you were by the light of day. Well, we rode back out to the spot. He asked us if this is where we had been dumped. I said, yes. He said, this is the very spot where they rob and usually kill white people, particularly missionaries, because that's not the only white people that go to Lagos, a few businessmen perhaps. But he said, this spot is noted for this kind of thing. He said there was a couple a week or two ago. He said they were robbed and killed here. And he said they never did find the bodies because often they cremate them to hide the evidence. Now he said, I'll drive you around the corner and show you what's around the corner. Drove us around the corner. There's a row of shacks about as far as we could see. He said, this is where the armed bandits live. He said, what they do is they send a man over to the airport to pose as a taxi driver. And the soldiers are in cahoots with them so that when someone gets off the plane and no one to meet them, naturally, you turn to someone in a uniform, and they direct them to these men, and they get a rake off of from the robbery. Well, we were thankful to the Lord that the Lord had preserved us. And I will say that you learn the power of two things in a land like that. You learn the power of the Word of God and the power of prayer, because there's nothing else. There's no 800 number. There's no police to turn to. None of the props that we have in a land like this, and I don't mean we despise the mercies God has given us in a land like this, but you learn there in a remarkable way the power of those two things. You open the Word of God, you rest on a promise, and you pray your way through it. Now perhaps I should just mention too, I put a map up here. We flew initially, of course, to Lagos. Now, the compound that we stayed at, the missionary compound we stayed in Lagos, was not the compound that we had been sent to initially, and the compound where others have stayed, John Kemp and Tom Roach and others. That compound is in the process of closing down. In fact, our driver that night, when he took us into Lagos, we had the address of a place we thought we were going to stay. When we got there, they told us that we couldn't stay there, but they were directing people to another compound, which we finally got to about midnight that night. So we stayed in Lagos for a few days. Brother Walt had some contacts he wanted to make, and we wanted to try to clear this shipment of Bibles. We also, of course, wanted to visit the assembly there, which we did, and we had a happy time. We then flew from Lagos to Port Harcourt. And then we traveled overland up to Aba and made a little circle here. There's an assembly in Lagos, one here in Itanan, and one up here in Arachuca. Now, we didn't get to Arachuca. It was still the end of rainy season, and they warned us that the roads were about impassable, and that even if we did go through, it would take what would be a two-hour trip would take about 8 or 10 hours. And so we didn't attempt to go to Arachuca. Maybe I should just give you a little of the background of what's transpired in Nigeria in the last year, because This will help you to understand why there is such political and civil unrest and why it is so dangerous to travel in Nigeria. Now, all this colored section is Nigeria. Nigeria had an election about a year and a half ago. The man that is supposed to have been elected is now in jail. His name is Abiola. The government, the country is under military rule. General Abachi is the dictator. And the people rebelled this past summer by having general strikes. Nigeria is an oil-rich nation. In fact, the United States buys more oil from Nigeria than any other single country in the world. The petroleum industry basically shut down. It caused civil and political unrest and a lot of bloodshed. Labor Day Monday, General Abachi took control again and quashed the strikes. But it's a very volatile situation. Now, what happens is, in a country like Nigeria, there are 250 tribes within this country. There are four principal tribes. You have the Fulanis in the north, which are the farmers and herdsmen. And then you have three tribes that have any clout, the Yoruba, the Hausa, and the Igbo. Now, as we look at an election in a third world country, and see the scenario unfold that you often get. To us, it looks like a struggle between the people and the military for democracy. But that's not really what it is. It becomes tribal feuding. Now, those tribal feuds and difficulties are hundreds of years old, and they are only re-sparked by the forcing of democracy on the country. Because what happens is, a man will be elected from one of the principal tribes. The man who was elected, Abiola, he's from the Yoruba tribe, but this does not sit well with the Hausa and the Igbo tribes. And so usually what happens is they have a coup, a military leader will take over. Abiola now is in prison. He's being tried for treason. The last weekend we were in Nigeria, they blew up his plane and reclaimed his farmland, which caused things to start to boil again. And if they kill Abiola, or he dies in prison, it will be bloodshed over there. It will be widespread civil war, because the tribes will just turn on one another. I would just say, concerning the brethren in Lagos, they realize the danger because some of them are outside of their tribal territory. 2.5 years ago, when they had a military coup, Brother Udopia, who runs the book room, he took his family back to the east so that if civil war broke out, they would be within their tribal territory. And so the brethren have no illusions as to the dangers, and it's really a matter of concern and prayer, and we need to pray for our brethren in Nigeria. The other difficulty is that the country is almost solid Muslim now, particularly in the north. It seems like there's a line drawn across the continent, and it's slowly moving down and becoming a Muslim continent. And, of course, the Muslims are the most militant of all the world religions. In the Quran, they conquer by the sword. And so they have no sympathy with Christianity or any other religion for that matter. And so the door is slowly closing over there. It's still fairly Christian in the south. We heard all kinds of stories about missionaries who have been killed in the north in the last year or two. Now you'll notice that the country is divided into 19 states on this map. In the last few months, it's been redivided, and there are now 30 states in Nigeria, mostly having to do with the tribal territory, but it makes it very difficult to travel overland in Nigeria, because every time you cross a state boundary, which is maybe, seemed like every 15 or 20 miles, you have a military and a customs checkpoint. And I did find it a little unnerving to have machine guns waved at me every 15 or 20 miles. What they're looking for is money. They want to extract money from you. They also want to steal your passport. And so we were warned not to travel with our passport and visa when we traveled in the country, but to take a photocopy of it and to leave the visa in Lagos at the missionary compound under lock and key because they can resell a passport. They can't resell a photocopy. What happens is the drivers don't like to stop at these checkpoints, and so they try to avoid them, which is sometimes a little nerve-wracking. We're coming along to a checkpoint, and when they get out in the country, they drive fast. About 140 kilometers an hour in the rain. We were driving on a straight stretch. We just had that van going for all it was worth. There was a military checkpoint ahead, and what they do is they have 2x4s with nails in them about every 3 inches, and they slide them across the road to stop the traffic. They don't stop all the traffic, they stop as much as they can handle at a time. Our driver said, well, we're not stopping here, and without even braking, he pulled over onto the mud and went on his way. Sometimes they shoot out the tires, but I think in this case they had stopped enough behind us that they were satisfied. The drivers don't want to stop any more than you do because they know that what they want is money. Now, maybe just a word about flying internally, domestically in the country. I thought I knew all about flying until I flew from Lagos to Port Harcourt and back. We didn't have too much problem going over, but what happened was that last weekend when things began to boil again, the oil prices, the petroleum prices skyrocketed. In fact, all the prices did. Now, we had paid 1,650 naira each to fly from Lagos to Port Harcourt. 50 naira in a dollar, American dollar. We paid $1,650 each to fly over on a Thursday. On Lord's Day afternoon, when we went to fly back, the price had gone up to 3,000 naira. Well, what happened was we got to the airport Lord's Day afternoon, and there was one flight left for Lagos that day. What they do over there is they begin selling tickets in the morning, and they don't count the number of flights or the number of seats that are going to be. They just sell tickets as long as they've got tickets printed. Well, what happened was there were about twice as many of us as there was room on the plane. Not only that, but the price had gone up that afternoon. Now, just because you bought a ticket at 10 o'clock, the next fellow bought one at 12 o'clock doesn't mean he'll necessarily go first. When they open the gate and call the flight, it's whoever can run or push the hardest that gets on the plane. Well, everyone was pushing for the flight, but what they decided to do was to check tickets on the tarmac and make people pay the difference. Because some had bought their tickets in the morning and paid one price, we who had bought them in the afternoon paid another. Well, it caused a riot. In fact, I believe if they hadn't got the army out to squash it, they would have ripped the wings off that plane. Those people were so mad. And the brother who was traveling with us, the native brother, Brother Idara, whose picture we'll see in a few moments, he said, we better stand back, because he said, when they start swinging those steel whips, they'll swing them indiscriminately. Anyway, they very quickly quashed the riot. I was determined to get on the plane because I didn't want to stay in Port Harcourt with nowhere to go. Port Harcourt is a large city. I was determined to get on the plane. Now, when we had gone to the airport, they said they were going to quit selling tickets. I don't know why, because they'd already sold lots more than they were able to accommodate, but they said they were not selling any more tickets that day. Well, Brother Idara saw a man behind the counter that he had lived with when they went to college. So he disappeared around the counter. A little while, he came back. He got us two tickets for three people. But the man assured him that he would get on, that we would all get on. Well, Brother Walt and I got on by sheer force. Brother Adair didn't make it, even though this man had promised him that he would. They held the plane about an hour, trying to get as many people on as they can. What they did was they take small children, put two or three in one seat to make another seat. They pack them in the galley where the stewardesses work. They stand up in there, and they sit in the aisle. So when we took off from Port Harcourt, it was standing room only, literally. There's no FDA regulations in Nigeria. However, not everybody could get on, Idara included. And I guess I was more concerned for us than I was for him, because he's from the East, and I knew he could handle himself. What I feared was landing in Lagos at night again after the experience the week before. Well, the Lord really rebuked my faith, because I had sat on that plane while we waited and pleaded with the Lord to let Adara on. However, the Lord had something better in mind. The other concern I had about Adara was that I had handed him the 3,000 naira for his ticket, but I knew that he didn't have very much over and above that, and I also knew that the next day the ticket was going to cost 5,000 naira. And so I knew he wouldn't have enough to return by plane, and I figured he would have to travel overland. However, the next noon, Adara showed up in Lagos. He was quite happy and told us how the Lord had undertaken for him. The man that he had met there that he had lived with previously, when he had lived with him, he said that this man was almost a borderline criminal. But Adara found out that he had got saved in the meantime since he had seen him last. The man took him home for the night. This man had got saved, but his wife hadn't. Adara proceeded to give her the gospel that evening, and she got saved. Then the Lord rewarded him. The next morning, this friend took him back to the airport. He found out that another airline, ABC, had stockpiled fuel, and they were selling tickets at the old price until the fuel ran out. So he returned the next day for less than we had. So it was really a rebuke to my faith, and the Lord always has his way in these things. As I say, the political and civil unrest has made it very dangerous and very hard to travel. And so that's why we flew to Port Harcourt, and then we traveled overland and made these other contacts. Well, maybe what I will do is, if someone can get the lights, we'll start the pictures. Now, a few of these pictures are dark, and you'll have to forgive my photography because my wife is a photographer. What I wanted to do was to get a picture of some of these suitcases. It had been recommended to us that what we do was to have these calendars and literature packed in suitcases like this. It's easier to handle, plus it looks less suspicious. At BTP, they have a machine to put metal strapping around it, so each suitcase had two metal straps to hold them together. When we got to that first compound that Friday night, I said to the lady that came out to meet us, I said, I'd like to get rid of this driver. He's bothering me for another $50. I said, even though we can't stay here, I'd like to unload, and then we can make some further arrangements, which we did. She suggested that we leave the luggage there under lock and key that night and come for it the next day. And one of their men then took us over to the compound where we stayed. Then the next day, when we made contact with Brother Eudokia, who runs the book room, he was able to hire a van and to go and get the literature. This is largely afternoon up at his place. After meeting, we helped him unpack it. This is a street scene, typical street scene in Lagos. Now, it's a little difficult to take pictures, particularly in the cities, because it's illegal to take a picture of a public building. It's illegal to take a picture of any government building, any monument, any policeman, military, as well as the fact that it's against the Muslim religion to have their picture taken. So you can't just go around candidly snapping pictures. If you took anybody's picture, you always made sure you had their consent first. And if they even suspect that you've taken a picture of something you shouldn't have, they will confiscate your camera or even arrest you. You also can't take a picture at any airport. So these were taken from Brother Eudokia's home. Now, this is Brother Clement of the assembly in Lagos. wanted me to get his picture reading his Bible. Maybe I should just tell you that of all things for me to forget, I forgot my letter of commendation. And I had been warned that that's something that they're very careful about over there, and I appreciate how careful they are about some things that sometimes we take for granted or let slip. What happened was my carry-on bag was so full when we left Chicago that I took my Bible and hymn book out of the Bible case and never took the letter out. Well, I mentioned this to Brother Eudopia the night before, Saturday night, and I could tell he was not very happy. He said, we'll have to see about it in the morning. Well, I really made it a matter of prayer that evening, and I realized that I had the presence of mind to take my list of gatherings. So the next morning when we went up for the meetings, I explained to him that I had my list of gatherings with me. I showed him that my name was under Smith Falls. Now, he knew there had been a new list come out, but he hadn't seen it. So I showed him my name under Smith Falls. He then took it and quickly flipped to the back to the section under Africa and was quite relieved to see that his name was under Lagos. However, that was not the end of the situation. They decided then to have a brothers' meeting about it. So we delayed the breaking of bread until they had a 20-minute brothers' meeting. Then they came out and they told me that they would allow me to break bread that morning. As the meeting began, Brother Eudopia stood up and very carefully went over the details of what had happened and why they were going to allow me to break bread. Then they read Brother Walt's letter and made a great effort to say how much they appreciated him bringing the letter and to thank him so much. And so I was sufficiently rebuked. The next Lord's Day in Ekanan, I had to basically go through the same routine. It was not enough that Walt would vouch for me, nor was it enough that I had broken bread in Lagos the week before. And so they're very careful about these things, and you do appreciate their faithfulness. This is Brother Monday of the assembly in Lagos. This is Brother Eudopia and his wife. Brother Eudopia runs the book room there. There are two sisters in fellowship in Lagos. Brother Eudopia's wife is one of them. This is Brother Eudopia's five children. Two little ones. This is sharing a meal with the brethren on Lord's Day. What they did was they had the breaking of bread, which lasted, I think, about 2 hours. They sing both out of the little flock and the echoes of grace at any meeting. A hymn can be given out of either one. It's interesting, before they start to sing the hymn, two or three brothers will hum the tune up through the first verse to get the right key. And so you just hold back and wait for them to hum the first verse, and then they say that they'll sing it. Singing is very nice. They then had a ministry meeting after the breaking of bread, which probably lasted just slightly over an hour. And then we shared a meal together. You notice the bottle of water there. I had been given that bottle of water at the compound that morning before we left. The night we got there, we got to the compound about midnight. I hadn't brushed my teeth since Chicago. And so I took out my toothbrush, put my teeth under the tap, and gave them a good hearty brushing. When we went up for breakfast the next morning, the lady of the house said, now remember, don't even brush your teeth under the tap, because many have got sick by doing it. Anyway, I just committed it to the Lord, and I didn't have any problem. In the dish on the far end of that tray, you have plantain. Plantain is a fruit that looks something like a banana, only it's larger. It doesn't turn yellow, it's green. They take it and they slice it, and they fry it in palm oil. It's very good, and you know it's safe to eat because it's been in a peel and then it's been cooked. What was in the other dish, I didn't ask. I usually found that was the best way. Over there, they serve you what they call bush meat, which basically means anything they caught in the bush. They eat a lot of rat, a lot of bush dog, They eat an animal they call a guinea pig, and it certainly looks like a guinea pig, only it's considerably larger, more the size of a groundhog. I put a poster at the back of the room under the clock, and afterwards you can look at it and you'll see a picture of the meat market. I said there was only one thing that smelt worse than the streets of Lagos, and that was to walk through the meat market at 110 degrees and this meat hanging and sitting just open on these tables. You try not to breathe any more than you have to. One night we were having some meat, I believe it was rat. Brother Walt said to me, he said, "What do you think we're eating?" I said, "I don't know, but please don't ask, because I said, so far I'm getting it down." I will say that what they do is they put enough sauce and spice on it that it can slide down pretty good if you're not sure what you're eating. One more little incident about food. They have big square-looking loaves of bread, rectangular-looking loaves of bread over there. You see the ladies on the street with big pans on their head with this bread stacked up high, and they're selling it. I figured it was pretty safe to eat since it's baked in an oven and then it's wrapped in cellophane, until one day I saw how they delivered it to these girls. The baker pulled up in his car, opened the trunk of this car that was just rust and dirt. The trunk was jammed full of these loaves of bread, unwrapped. He then took the loaves of bread, unwrapped, out of the trunk and set them on the street and proceeded to wrap them. However, when we went back to where we were staying that night, they put a big loaf of bread on our table for our supper, and we were hungry by that time. So we ate heartily and thanked the Lord for it and ate heartily, and the Lord took care of us. Neither Walt nor I had a day where we even felt a little squeamish. So we were thankful for that. I wondered how we were going to do for liquid over there, but Coca-Cola is the universal drink. In fact, you go out in the villages, some little mud store with a thatched roof, but they sell Coca-Cola, about 4 or 5 cents a bottle. No deposit on the bottle, but you couldn't take the bottle with you. You had to drink it right there, which wasn't too hard at 110 degrees. So we were thankful. Now this is Brother Idara and his wife. She's the other sister in fellowship, and they have a little boy. Brother Idara is a sweet brother, faithful brother, and he's the brother that traveled with us later on when we traveled to Port Harcourt and visited the assembly at Evenan and made the other contacts in the east. This is their outside their home. Brother Idara is an accomplished musician. I let Mark hear some of his tapes, which he has had produced. And I think you will agree that he is very good on the keyboard. This is his keyboard. This is Lord's Day afternoon. We went to his home after the meetings, and he can make tremendous music from that keyboard. We had a little hymn sing. That's Brother Walt in the corner there. It was hard for the brethren to comprehend that Brother Walt turned 75 just before we went, because over there the conditions are so harsh that 56 is considered a very old person. Brother Walt would tramp all day in the hot sun with a bag of tracks under his arm, and this was just a source of amazement. In fact, I believe that his age, Brother Walt's age, helped us through a lot of situations. Because as corrupt as the society is over there, they still honor age. They have a great respect for the older ones, and I think it got us through many scrapes. In fact, I wondered after if that wasn't one of the reasons why we got on the plane that afternoon in Port Harcourt. Now this is Brother Eudophia. Brother Eudophia, as I say, runs the book room over there. He spends many hours in correspondence and mail order and so on. Over there you have to, there's no telephones or communication like we have over here. And so you have to get a driver to take you out to find people. And we got there on a Friday night, of course. Saturday we had a driver take us to Brother Eudophia's house. He wasn't there, but his wife said she would tell him we had arrived, and we gave her our address, and he then made contact with us Saturday afternoon. It makes it kind of difficult because it's not like over here where you could make 3 or 4 phone calls in the morning and set up appointments. so you have to move a little slower. This is another typical scene in Lagos. Lagos is a city of a guesstimated population of between 11 and 12 million people. 90 million people live in the country of Nigeria. Again, that's a guesstimated population because it's about impossible to take a census, really. Wall-to-wall people in Lagos. Yeah, I would say that Lagos is about, or that Nigeria is about the square mileage of the state of Texas, so that gives you some idea. You can imagine 90 million people squeezed into those few square miles. This is the missionary compound where we stayed in Lagos. It was a mercy of the Lord that we were directed to this place, not only for the safety factor, but with the contacts we wanted to make over there, we were able to meet many at this place that were able to direct us to people that could help us. One of the other reasons we went over was to check on the feasibility of printing literature and calendars right in Nigeria, rather than trying to get them in, so we were able to check on that. This is the only compound of its kind left in Lagos. And so any missionaries from other parts of the country who are have to come to Lagos on business or who are flying out of the country usually end up staying at least one night at this place. You know, I really admired the resident missionaries in Nigeria. It was one thing for us to go over for 2 weeks and then get out, but to live in the uncertainty that these folks do from day to day, you really have to do it for the Lord. And the men and women that we met over there were men and women of God. And they have a love for the people too, because there's no other motive for doing it, for living in those conditions, other than you're doing it for the Lord and you love the native people. Notice this man and his wife were really sweet Christians. They really put themselves out for the Lord and for the Lord's people. This is the man at the compound, this is the carpenter at the compound they had hired. Now those boards on this particular day were just rough cut boards. They were neither planed nor sanded, but he was working on it this afternoon, and by the next morning he had the bed made. The wood was just as smooth as if he'd bought it in the store over here. The Nigerians are very talented people. This was our houseboy, Joshua. They had a lawnmower at the compound, but usually the Nigerians cut the grass with machetes, and it's amazing to watch them do it, how fast they can do it and how even they get the grass. This is the van that we rode in to make our contacts in Lagos, and this was our driver, Francis. Now, every time we sat down in this van, we were reminded of the dangers because the seats were riddled with bullet holes. Francis lifted his sleeve and showed us two fresh wounds. What had happened was that a few days before we got there, Francis was taking the man and the woman that we saw in the last picture out to, I think they were going up to Abaddon on a mission. The armed bandits came out of the jungle. And Francis knew that there was a town just up ahead, a village up ahead, so he decided to make a run for it. Well, they chased him and eventually shot out the tires. They were going so fast at that point that the van flipped over on its roof. The bandits kept shooting. Francis got two wounds under the arm. The other missionaries just got cut from the broken glass. As the bandits approached the van, the villagers began coming out to see what was going on, and when they saw the villagers, the bandits took off. They were able to bind up this man's wounds and stop the bleeding and get him to a medical facility and save his life. This man knew Lagos like the back of his hand. It didn't matter what address or what part of the city we wanted to visit or try to make contact in, he seemed to know where he was going, so we really did appreciate his service. We were glad to have these four guard dogs at night. One thing Nigerians are very afraid of is dogs. This is Ruby. There were four girls worked at the compound, all sweet Christian girls. Ruby's carrying a box of Bibles on her head. You see the women carrying things on their head all the while. We would go along and see three men have to lift the load up onto the woman's head, and she would walk away with it as if it didn't weigh anything. Sometimes they would lift bags of flour and all kinds of things, 50, 60, 70 pounds, and they would carry it. They also had big trays on the street. They would build up limes and oranges in a pyramid on these trays, and the girls would carry them on their head. It amazed me that they didn't roll, because one false move, you'd think the pyramid would start to roll, but it didn't seem to. While we're looking at this compound, just a little incident that took place. Most nights we heard shooting. One night I had gone into our room about 9 o'clock, and I was stretched out on the bed trying to unwind a little bit. Brother Walt came in a little later, and I said, "The shooting's terrible tonight, isn't it?" And it was. It was just continual gunfire. Well, Brother Walt said, "I think it's firecrackers." The thing was that that had been their day at National Day of Independence, and I guess he thought it was 4th of July in Lagos. However, Brother Walt is a man of tremendous composure and tremendous faith, and he convinced himself of this fact that it was firecrackers, lay down like Peter in prison, and went sound asleep. I prayed for a couple of hours while the gunfire continued. The next day we found out that there'd been quite a lot of bloodshed just around the corner, which is not uncommon. Now, these next pictures are dark, but what this is, we were able to have a little hymn sing in time with some Muslim children. These would be children that wouldn't normally be allowed to come to any kind of a Christian service, but for some reason they were allowed to come, so we were able to sing with them and have a little word. Now, again, it's dangerous to take pictures in Lagos particularly. This was the best I could do for Lagos traffic. It really is indescribable. It's wall to wall. There are no stop signs, no traffic lights, no laws, no street signs. We did see some policemen directing traffic one afternoon. There were